Now, International Women's Day, March 8th, 1981, continues with tapes edited from an event which took place in Newark, New Jersey today, and was one of the several events that took place around the city, indeed around the metropolitan area, to mark International Women's Day. I'm Eileen Zalisk, and I'm here with Pat Simon, who went to Newark and attended what I think was probably one of the largest women's events ever held in New Jersey. At least it was promoted that way, and apparently it turned out that, in fact, that happened, which is encouraging in these difficult times for the women's movement. Pat, why don't you just talk a little bit about what it was like?
It was really a very moving experience. There was hundreds of women, and they marched from downtown Newark to Essex County Community College, and the auditorium was filled. It was a large festival with many booths, and it was called a festival in celebration of International Women's Day. There were several speakers, and two of whom we will hear tonight. There was Crystal Lee Sutton, who we will be listening to a tape about, and there was Kathy Andrade, who is from El Salvador.
And it was sponsored by the United Auto Workers and the National Organization for Women, and a coalition of women's groups and organizations that I think have had some difficulty coming together and working together before this event. And I think that people in that area were quite excited about that happening, particularly now when there's some real question about the future of the women's movement, and when women's issues in the women's movement indeed seems to be under such assault by the Reagan administration. So I think that people there were really feeling quite encouraged about the fact that this could happen at all. I think that you said that you had two speakers that we were going to hear, and the first one is Kathy.
First one is Kathy Andrade, and she is from El Salvador. She will be speaking about the situation in El Salvador, and I think you will find it most interesting.
Okay, and after that, we'll break after Kathy Andrade, and we'll be hearing Crystal Lee Sutton, who is the real Norma Rae, the person who was depicted, apparently not with total accuracy, in that a very popular film. And there's one thing I do want to say, that there is a slight problem with the sound quality. You may have to strain to hear, but if you do, it's worth straining to hear.
Distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, amigos todos, I am deeply touched by this great honor, being part of this Women International Day gives me more than honor to me. I was born in the Republic of El Salvador in Central America. So you can imagine how I feel when I see the intervention of the government of the United States being physically there, killing the thousands of peasants in the mountains. I'd like to tell you something about El Salvador, because I have no idea how much you know about this little republic. El Salvador is the smallest country in the continent of America. We are overpopulated, of course. We have 5.5 million people. Mostly agricultural country. It is controlled by 20 millionaire families. 20 families control the nation. They have been exploiting and abusing not only women, men too. The multinationals, of course, are physically there. I believe they have about $60 million of investment. And this is one of the reasons why the government of the United States is protecting those 20 families and those $60 million. Our nation is a Catholic nation. Some people have been very critical of the Catholic Church for their participation. But I must tell you, the Catholic Church has been physically there long before our National Independence Day. It was the Catholic priests who inspired the independence in 1821 in our country. And all the patriots of our independence were priests. Our nation is not a communist nation, we are Christian. 90% of our people are Catholics. And believe me, I can guarantee you that the Catholic Church managed to brainwash us from the day we were born to be anti-communist. The Catholic Church has been working on the fields in every corner of the nation. The Catholic Church has been the only shelter and the only place where people, poor people, can go and bring their sorrows. Of course, the Catholic Church has been the first target for this fascist government, these criminals. 12 priests have been murdered, brutally murdered. All the catechists have been killed. The Catholic Church, as you know, they were quiet, and they work down with the people. They're very effective. And they have been teaching the peasants how to organize cooperatives. And this has been the greatest crime the Catholic Church has committed. And this is why they also kill our bishop, as you know, while praying Mass. It is very difficult for us to understand why this government is protecting the government that kill American citizens. You are all aware of the four nuns that were killed and the two lawyers that were representing the ABO. They were there to see the implementation of the agrarian reform so badly needed. They have been talking about agrarian reform since 1942, when the revolution overthrew the dictatorship that was established for 15 years. Under the sponsorship and the support of the government in the United States. Unfortunately, it has been the tradition of the Pentagon not to change the rules. They make no evaluations of changes. All they do is support military regimes. My country has been on the military regime for the past 50 years. We are tired, we had it. People have been killed. For 50 years, in 1934, 42,000 peasants were killed because of a crime for agrarian reform. That was the only crime, believe me, they're not coming in El Salvador. We have nationalists willing to die and defend the nation's rights. We need your support. We have, the revolution of El Salvador has tremendous support from the European countries, from Mexico, from many other countries in Latin America who are not controlled under military regimes. This Tuesday, President Reagan is meeting with the government of Canada to dialogue about fishing rights. Nevertheless, a statement was issued yesterday by the government of Canada. And this agenda, they have their opposition for the intervention in El Salvador, and they want this country to stop.
That was Kathy Andrade, the educational director of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union Local 23 to 25.
And you're listening to tapes edited and selected from an event that took place today in Newark, New Jersey. Pat Simon was there. She taped it. And what's next?
Next, we will hear from Crystal Lee Sutton, the real Norma Ray. But before we go into the tape, one thing I'd like to add is that Crystal Lee Sutton mentioned to me today that there are jeans out now being called Norma Ray jeans, which she has no affiliation with, and she's really fairly anti-against. So I thought that would be an important note for you to know. All right, we'll now be hearing from Crystal Lee Sutton.
And once again, the sound quality on this is not of the best, and you will have to strain to hear it, but I do think it's worth listening to.
Our next speaker for the day, and we're going to hear from a woman whose story was depicted in the popular movie Norma Ray. She is a woman who realized that the way for women to combat economic discrimination was for women to organize into unions. Her story and her courage in the face of adversity should be an inspiration for us all. I've heard her called lately the modern day Mother Jones of the South, Crystal Lee Sutton.
Hello. My name is Crystal Lee Sutton and I hail from Burlington, North Carolina.
Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. J.P. Stevens has 7 plants in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. And in 1972, I went to work for J.P. Stevens. J.P. Stevens is the second largest textile industry in the world. In 1973, I had been out of work because I broke my foot working at J.P. Stevens. And when I returned to work, my sister, who was working in my department, came down to me and she called me Lee. She said, Lee, somebody's handing out union cards, but don't you take one because if you do, you'll be fired. Well, right away, I got to thinking about long ago when the first thing I ever heard about unions was my daddy and mama were working for Cone Mills in Hall River, North Carolina. Daddy said, honey, he said, I can get you a job working down there with us, but they've got a union. But don't you have nothing to do with it, because if you do, you'll get fired. In 1962, I married Mr. Jordan, who was portrayed in the movie as Sonny. And he belonged to the union. He worked for the paper mill. He had about 5 weeks paid vacation. He even had his birthday off with pay. He was making at that time about $7 an hour. And things started running through my mind. My parents had been in textile all their life. They only had 1 week's paid vacation. They didn't have any kind of retirement plan. And I got to thinking about, well now, what can be so bad about unions if the union has did this for Mr. Jordan? I asked around to a lot of people, and because I had always been so good friends with management, which was male, everybody thought that I was a company spy. But finally, one woman told me, she said, Lee, there's a notice about it on the bulletin board. So I took a pencil and a piece of paper and I went up to the bulletin board and I copied down the time and the place. The meeting was going to be held on Mother's Day in May of 1973. And I went to my first union meeting, which was held in an all-black church, and there was about 5 white people there. I just automatically went down to the front and sat on the front row. The organizer, his name is Eli Zipsovich, who is an ex-coal miner from Fairmont, West Virginia. He made me a believer that day. He said, textile workers are very important people because in a world without textile, we'd all have to shake ourselves dry. You know, when I was a little girl, I was always called a tomboy. But after having met Gloria Steinem and a lot of smart, educated women since then, I've realized that I wasn't a tomboy. I've just been liberated all my life. How many of you have seen the movie Norma Rae? Well, when I attended my first union meeting, Eli gave us a big button that said TWA, which at the time was the Textile Workers Union of America. He said that we needed to wear that button at all times inside the plant so that if the company did start harassing us or making any change in our working conditions or did fire us, that it was no way they could say beyond the shadow of a doubt that they did not know we were for the union. The first day that I went to work wearing that button, the people in management who had always been my friends, you would have thought I had a terrible disease. The only time they talked to me was when they were calling me in the office. My job was sort of right out front here. The main entrance was about as far as this wall. That was the main entrance, the men's bathroom, the bulletin board, the water fountain, and the woman's bathroom. J.P. Stevens posted a notice on the bulletin board. And it was, in effect, trying to separate the blacks from the whites. It was putting fear into people. This is against the law during an organizing campaign for a company to try to make people afraid. Eli said that he needed a copy of that letter to send to the National Labor Relations Board. A lot of us tried to copy the letter, and when we did, we were told that if we copied the letter, we would be fired. So I went to Eli and I said, Eli, I said, they say they'll fire us if we copy that letter. He said, Crystal, I'm telling you, it's your constitutional rights that you can copy down anything the company puts up there for you to read. And I got to thinking back to when I copied down the time and the place for the first union meeting and nobody said anything to me. So I told Eli, I said, I'll copy that letter. Well, Lord and behold, that day when I went into work, there was a table, long table down there, and I remember the company was giving us a safety meeting supper. And this is when the companies say that they have had no lost time accidents.
which is nothing but a lie. Because these companies will, people will get hurt on the job, and these companies will bring people into work and set them in the office and let them set up 8 hours and pay them 8 hours work. Well, until 1973, when the union came to town, we thought the company was doing us a favor. We didn't know about workman's compensation. We didn't know about brown lung, the disease that you get from breathing the fine lint in the cotton mill. I called Eli on the payphone, which the company had installed for us to use at any time if we needed to keep us out of the office. And I told him, I said, Eli, I said, man, I said, I can't copy that letter tonight. I said, we're having a safety meeting somewhere. And then I had to tell him what that was. He said, and I said, Eli, I'm hungry. I said, I think I'm gonna eat. He said, Crystal, he said, you can afford to lose a few pounds if I do that. So I said, okay, Eli, I get it. But I came up with this bright idea that different ones in the department would go up to the bulletin board and remember two lines of the paragraph. Murray would read two lines and memorize it, and we would go right in the bathroom and we would write it down. Well, it got to the point that we were so afraid of standing there that when we got to the bathroom, we would forget what we had read. So I told my sister, I said, Saritha, I said, can you get me a clipboard? She was the service person, and she was allowed to go back in the warehouse. She said, yeah, but what you going to do with it? I said, I'm going to copy that letter off the bulletin board. She said, oh, Lord. So on our break time, I took the clipboard, and I went to the bulletin board, and I started copying down the letter. Each man from management came up to me and told me that I could not copy the letter. And I just told them, you know, that it was my constitutional right and that it was my break time, and that they did what they wanted to on their break time. They even went out to the cafes to eat when we were not even allowed to go outside to sit on the steps. Mr. Mason Lee threatened to bring the police in. He told me that he would bring the police in and have them to take me away. And I told him that he'd have to do whatever he thought was necessary because I was going to copy that letter. Off the bulletin board, and as soon as my break time was over, they called me to the office. There was about 7 or 8 people from management, all men except for one woman, and Mr. Mason Lee started telling me the reasons he was firing me. And he said I had used a payphone when it wasn't my break time, I had stayed in the bathroom too long, just a lot of different things. And I told him, I put my hands over my ears and I said, Mr. Lee, sir, I said, I'm not going to say anything until you tell me the names of everybody in here and how to spell it. Well, he started to do that. And then he said, I don't have to do that. I told him, I said, there's no need for me to say anything because there's nobody in here to take sides with me. You'll be right and nothing I say will have any meaning to it. Well, he made the mistake of allowing me to go back into the mill to get my pocketbook. I deliberately left my pocketbook inside the factory because I told my sister, I said, now, I don't know what they're going to do as soon as my break is over. I said, but I'm going to leave my pocketbook in here and you watch it. So Mr. Mason Lee told Tommy Gardner to go back to the plant and get my pocketbook. I said, if anybody goes inside that plant and touches my pocketbook, I'll have a warrant taken out for them. And he actually let me go back in the plant. So when he did, you know, people started to ask me right away, the ones in my department, what happened? And I realized that it was no way I would have time to go to everybody and tell them that I had been fired. So just on the spur of the moment, I said to Mary, who was a black woman next to me, I said, Mary, let me use your magic marker. She was always letting me use a magic marker. She was afraid to let me use her magic marker. So she gave it to me, and I took a piece of cardboard and I wrote the word union on it, and I stood up on the table, and I turned it around, and everything got real quiet. Back giving me the victory sign. Men in the warehouse were standing out looking through the window just giving me the victory sign. And it was a strange feeling because I realized, you know, all of a sudden that the people in there were behind me, that even though I have all the desperation that I would talk to them and I would have meetings in the canteen to the point where the company built a special canteen. There were 7 or 8 women in my department. I was a gift set maker. Like when you go into Sears and Kenya's and you see real towels folded real pretty and put in boxes, that was my job. They built a special canteen for me and the other 7-8 in my department to go to and eat. We were no longer allowed to go to the other canteen where the majority of the workers went. That's how far they went, to separate me from the rest of the workers. And I realized, you know, that even though those workers had been afraid to support me inside the plant, that when it came down, when I held up the sign union, they were willing to jeopardize their job and cut the machines off. And that was a good thing. The chief of police said, who was my first cousin's husband. He told me that he was going to give me a ride home. But when I got to the door and we started outside the gate, I saw the police car. And I realized then that he was taking me to jail. And I've got pictures of bruises on my arms where he and the other policeman forced me into the police car. He did take me to jail and he locked me up. I was only there for a couple of hours, but it seemed like an eternity. Because all my life started passing before me. You know, I said, Lord, nobody knows where I'm at. But I remembered one thing. I remembered when I watched Perry Mason, I told Chief Police, I said, you have to let me make one phone call. And he did. And so I called the union guy, Eli Zinn. And the chief of police was so shocked because he just knew I was going to call my husband. And he took me on to jail. And I got to think that, you know, nobody knows where I am. If Eli doesn't get this message, then I don't know. I just didn't know what the police department was going to do with me. But in a few hours, Eli came down and he got me out. The warrant was something to the effect that I had used profanity. It never went to court. Never went to court. They dropped the charges. But it never undid the fact that I had to spend some time in jail. The jail was way off to itself, and a woman did not take me to jail. The chief of police himself took me down to the jail and locked the door behind me. Mr. Jordan, who's portrayed as Sonny, didn't want me to go to work to begin with. But I felt like that God would bless me with three beautiful children, and as their mother, it was my responsibility to help provide a decent way of life for them. He made good money, but he still didn't make enough money to help give the children the proper dental care that they needed. And, you know, I always wanted my children to be able to take dancing or music lessons so that they would have a talent. And so that was the reason I went to work, to help give my children the little extras that I wanted them to have, things that I didn't have. He wanted me to stay home and raise the children. But I felt like, you know, it made me feel better to go out and work with the public. I felt like I could be a better wife and mother and take the financial strain off of having to ask Mr. Jordan for every nickel that I got. I had my own spending money. He did want me to go to my first union meeting, which I couldn't understand because he was a union member, and I couldn't understand how he could not want me to get involved in the union. In 1976, I left Mr. Jordan and I moved back to Burlington, North Carolina. We had the election in 1974 and the workers voted to be represented by the Textile Workers Union of America. And in 1976, the textile workers merged with the Amalgamated Clothing Textile Workers Union of America and a national boycott was started against J.P. Stevens products. In 1980, I started on a tour of the United States gaining support for the boycott against J.P. Stevens products, talking about the plight of the textile workers, and not only the textile workers, but poor people in general. I've had a lot of different jobs. I've been a maid, I've been a waitress, I've worked in a chicken factory, I've been a secretary, so you name it, I've done just about some of all of it. So I know what it's like, no matter where you work, being a woman is always hard. You never get to the top. Are expected to do a lot of the men's work if you never paid what men are paid. I was working at the Hilton Inn in 1979 for $2.95 an hour. My sons were working there, who at the time were 17 and 18 years of age, and they were making $3.25 an hour. Now that made me feel real good, and it made me wonder, you know, how could this be right? There I was about 38 years old, and my sons were being paid more money than I was because they were male. They were allowed to work in maintenance, and, you know, we had to be the maids or the waitresses, the barmaids or something like that. In 1980, October the 19th, the workers in Roanoke Rapids voted to ratify a contract with J.P. Stevens. The union took my case to the Second Circuit Court in New York City, and in August of 1978, J.P. Stevens had to give me my job back and pay me my back pay. Just a few moments for questions. If some of you have a particular question about the movie or the J.P. Stevens situation that you'd like to ask me. Yes?
What about Eli?
Eli is retired. He is back in Fairmont, West Virginia. He has black lung. So he's real interested in this thing that that President Reagan is trying to do about the black lung compensation. You know, I have been all over the United States, and Ronald Reagan won to be President of the United States, but everywhere I go, everybody's disappointed. And I'm wondering who voted for him. The responsibility of bearing the children. Women have been the ones that have brought these children up, and a lot of us have brought up young men. And I think that it's time that women got together. It has to be a woman out there smart enough to be President of the United States. Was given the chance to run this country because we did very well in our homes, and I think there has to be a woman capable of seeing that people are treated right, especially the poor working class of people. Thank you.
You've been listening to tapes edited and selected from an event that took place today in Newark, New Jersey, sponsored by the United Auto Workers, the National Organization for Women, and a coalition of women's organizations in the New York metropolitan area. That event was to mark this day, March 8, 1981, International Women's Day, 1981. I'm Eileen Zalisk, and I'm here with Pat Simon, who went to Newark and was recording that event. And with this coverage of that event, we end the programming for International Women's Day, March 8, 1981. Thank you for listening.